back on the record. We had a power outage at least a half hour here. But anyway, I want to welcome Representative Lynn, who joined us shortly before the power went out. And Liz, you were going to just, if you would, start over, identify yourself for the record, and proceed on the bill. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, my name is Liz Clement. I am staff to Representative Herron. As Representative Herron stated, just a brief recap of the bill. First of all, it's an efficiency measure. Currently, psychological associates who take the qualifying exam to work in their field in Alaska, if they do not pass it the first time, state law requires that they wait 6 months before taking it again. That law was put into effect when the exam was only offered every 6 months. It's now offered quarterly or every 3 months, and the board sees no need to make associates or associate applicants wait the full 6 months to take the exam again. As Representative Herron said, it also clarifies who's exempt from regulation by the board. All the existing exemptions remain in effect. There are clarifications for two groups: school psychologists who are licensed not by the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, but instead by the Department of Education and Early Development. I would just like to state that this bill would not impact them whatsoever. And also U.S. government employees who practice psychology while in the discharge of their official duties. The only people subject to board regulation and the only people this bill would affect are those who represent themselves to the public of Alaska as psychologists. You'll find in your committee packets several zero fiscal notes showing no significant cost to the state of Alaska. So it will cost the state no money. HB 110 is supported by the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, as well as the Association of Psychologists in Alaska. And with that said, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Through the chair, who asked for this to be introduced? Was there some kind of hole in the wall that they wanted be done?
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair. This was brought to my boss, Representative Herron, by one of his constituents, Dr. Lauren Bradbury, who is a psychologist practicing in Bethel, who I believe is also online to testify. He is also the current chair of the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners for the state.
And a follow-up?
Sure. Right.
Has there been a lot of people who haven't passed that 6 month wait is a bad thing?
I believe, Representative Wilson, through the chair, that would be a good question to ask Dr. Bradbury. I think he's in a better position to give you a good answer than I am.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify and give just a few more minutes for the people online to get back on if they want? Is there anybody online to testify?
There's one.
Yeah. Is there anybody online that would like to testify on HB 110 relating to the practice and licensing of psychologists? Check your mute button.
Hello.
Hello. Identify yourself.
This is Dr. Bradbury.
Please go ahead and give us your testimony on HB 110.
Okay, and I'm the chairman of the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. I think there was a question posed just a moment ago. They said it would be best referred back to me. And there are a number of people that don't pass that exam, and so it expedites things if they can retake it again the next cycle rather than waiting a full 6 months. So, and as far as the otherwise, I think that the information is provided here, at least the information I received from Representative Herron, it's well done, well said as far as our reason for wanting to clarify who needs to be licensed. Right now, the law is quite vague in one area, and that's addressed in the where it talks about questions and answers. And so I would be happy to answer any questions anyone might have, but I think it's the this addresses our concerns of trying to prevent harm to the public.
Any other questions for Dr. Burberry? Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else online that would like to testify? Okay, we'll close public testimony on HB 110. Let's see any with the wish of the committee or comments or.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to just say that I
represent the seat. I'm sorry for the record.
I appreciated getting the legal opinion on the question I'd asked previously, and that you know satisfied my question. Just so on the impact on the department or other workers in the state government, and so I just wanted to thank the sponsor for that, and just so that the public knew that those questions that I'd asked have been answered and resolved to my satisfaction.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
I represent Lindsay. Holmes. This is the first time I've done that.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Holmes.
I enjoy that. It's good fun. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to echo the comments by Representative Seaton that similarly last year I had some initial concerns my staff and I had, and that the sponsor's office has been extremely good about working with us, making sure all of our concerns were addressed, and I no longer have concerns about the bill.
Okay.
So thank you.
And Representative Lynn?
Well, I just want to say, if you wish to move the bill, I'd be happy to make the motion when you're ready.
I'm ready unless there's somebody else has a comment. I would like to point out that you asked a good question last session about the, you had pointed out about the pro bono would be out of the question, if you remember, and because of the for a fee, was and that's fixed in the bill. So, yeah, go ahead.
Or maybe our newest legislator might like to move the bill. Have you moved the bill yet?
No, I haven't.
There it is. Right. We got a cheat sheet up here.
Oh,
so.
Oh, there we go. Yes. Thank you. Okay.
Sir, Chair?
Mm-hmm. Representative Wilson.
I move HB 110 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Or by this is zero. Oh, I need to give this one. The 26.
Version.
Mm-hmm. 26LSO474/R.
With individual recommendations.
With individual recommendations. Thank you.
Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure that was the committee substitute bill. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So the first action of the year. Not bad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I'm a committee substitute.
So next before us, we have also have a bill, another bill we heard last year, and I know that's why many of you are here, HB 187. And it's an insurance mandate to cover treatment of autism spectrum disorder. And there were a number of questions raised last year, and I don't think, you know, because of it was only one session, we didn't get a chance to answer all the questions. And that's why we're continuing on here. We'll not move the bill today. And we will proceed with this bill in the future, depending on how the discussion goes. So there's a little question about the positive strides that have been made in treatment of autism. We've had testimony that ABA, the Applied Behavior Analysis, is working, and it's working well, and that there are savings, you know, in terms of dollars anyway, for society that are huge. And it's really great that we're looking at this. Most of the questions that came up in the bill are in the context of determining whether or not the insurance mandate is affordable. I just want to make a comment on that. Typically on a bill, like we pass a bill for a program, it gets a lot of scrutiny in our finance committee. And in this case, it's a mandate on the insurance company. So what happens is the analysis, the fiscal analysis, we have to look at it pretty closely in this policy committee because it isn't get the same level of scrutiny as another bill would, and especially in this case where we're asking, you know, one segment of the insured to pay the bill, and the benefit comes back to society as a whole. So it really behooves us, and I would encourage the committee to keep that in mind as we go on. We closed public testimony last session, but because of the long interim and because there were questions left unanswered, we're going to reopen public testimony, and we'll hear from the sponsor, Representative Pete Peterson. And we also, just today, received a blank CS. And so before you start, do we have does anyone on the committee want to move the CS for us so that is we're all talking from the same sheet of music? Representative Herring.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill 187, version 641/P.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd object to find out the differences between the original version and the CS.
Thank you. Representative Peterson, if you would, describe the differences, the differences are between the CS and the document, and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Right at the end. Reg Legal had some suggestions about the definition of medically necessary, and so they moved it to section 21-42-.397E to clarify that the requirement that covered treatment be medically necessary applies to the whole bill and not just a specific a part of the bill or a section of the bill. It also was added to a subsection to clarify that treatment coordinated with education plans would only be covered if they're medically necessary. And additionally, the definition of autism service provider was expanded to be more specific. The new language was taken from Colorado statutes. We also changed the effective date of the bill, and the date for the inflation adjustment was changed to reflect the fact that the bill did not pass last year. So those were the changes from the original bill.
Thank you. Any questions on that?
And Mr. Chairman, I'd remove
Representative Cedar. Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor at this time? And we'll come back to this in the committee and we can ask them to see. We've got plenty of time. Let's go ahead. Are there any questions at this point? Representative Sisto.
I'm just wondering if we've got people online or here that are going to be able to maybe answer questions about what's happening out there.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm wondering about the requirements of insurance currently in Alaska. Do we allow insurance plans? I know we have a maximum limit that's available. You know, it's $1 million or $2 million. But do we allow insurance plans to say that they will only cover $50,000 of cervical cancer? Or that breast cancer is limited to $20,000 coverage? Or in this case, we're saying that there's going to be a limitation of $36,000 on autism care. Is that a provision that is allowed currently within medical plans or insurance in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't really know that answer for certain. I'm sure Linda Hall would probably be able to answer that for us, and I don't know if she's online or today or not. I did talk to her the other day, but that was not one of the questions that we covered. So,
Representative Seed,
thank you, Chairman, and that's fine. You know, we're going to hear it again. So, but I do want to get that answered, because if we're going down a line that's saying we are going to have insurance plans that have individual limits for individual diseases, we need to, we are starting that path here, and we need to know whether that then allows insurance companies to have an entire schedule of not a $1 million limit, but individual limits for individual diseases, which I can see being problematic in coverages for plans. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I appreciate you getting back to us on that.
Right. We've written it down.
There's a, I asked the sponsor a series of questions, and I think some of you have those, and I'm debating whether or not we ought to go through those now if time will allow, and I am thinking that we probably ought to get into the testimony because we have a pretty good sized list, but I guess there is one that I'd like to ask, and the first of all, does everybody on the committee, do you have the pie chart?
Right.
From Division of Insurance, should be in the packets. Just be clear that this mandate, this is testimony from last year, but this mandate covers just private commercial insurance, and that's 23% roughly of the people that are covered in the state of Alaska. And as I recall, we were talking about 48,000 children that would be covered. And I believe that must be about 23% of the number of children between birth and 20. You know, so that's the relative numbers. But the reason I'm going there, the question I'd like to ask before we get into the testimony is Mr. Is it Bowder testified last year that the cost estimates that he gave were based on various ranges of prevalence of autism spectrum disorder, and those numbers it don't seem to be consistent with the projected cost of in Alaska, and I just would we want to get into that some more, and I asked the question to Representative Peterson. I don't know if you want to address the respond now and we can talk about it, or if you'd like to put that off till after the testimony. So I'll leave it your call.
Mr. Chairman, it would all depend on the number of parents who seek treatment for their children. There are people who live off the road system in Alaska, in rural Alaska, that for some reason, I mean, there's very little, very few doctors, very little health facilities, few health facilities in those parts of the state. And so they don't have access to get to treatment for their children or to get them diagnosed. And so we don't know how many of those children would be brought into a larger city in Alaska to get diagnosed or to get treatment. So it's really a little hard to predict exactly how many people would be treated. We did get some information actually just this morning from Providence Hospital in Anchorage about their program, and someone had asked about whether there was a waiting list, and so I was trying to find out that information, and what the Providence Autism Diagnostic Network does is they see six kids a week, and I know that doesn't sound like many, but they go through 20 hours on each patient to do a very thorough diagnostic approach. And even with this 20-hour a week time, a long time that they're spending on these children, there's only a 2-month backlog. And that 2-month backlog is actually to work on the specific treatment. They actually are able to see the children to get them diagnosed with a less of a waiting period, but it takes longer for them to come up with the individual education plan and exactly how they're going to use the treatments to improve the child. So 2 months does sound like a long time, but in Seattle, the waiting list, from what I understand, is 6 to 8 months. So we're not in the woods compared to some other places. 6 to 8 months is a pretty long wait if you're a parent and your child has been diagnosed and you're waiting to get some treatment started. 2 months sounds like a long time, but actually that's not really like an extreme amount of time. Now, and then that actually might be shortened if this bill would pass, because typically more providers come to a state that has insurance coverage because they realize they'll be able to get paid for their services.
Okay, so there's no specific answer because we don't know how many parents are going to step forward, and we don't know how much they're going to travel as opposed to be treated at home. But how about the cost then of the actual insurance policy? The number that we were given is $3.60 per member in Alaska. And the numbers that Mr. Bowder gave us, he said that when there's a prevalence of 1 to 400, it was $2.24 per member. And then he went down a scale. It becomes more prevalent at 1 to 325, and that was 3 something. And I think 1 to 250 was 581. And now I thought your new information said that the states that have put this mandate in place, it's 1 to 100. And that's really a lot more prevalent, you know. And I, that's why I have trouble coming back and figuring out how that could be $3.60, you know, and maybe you could explain that. And the insurance costs, the actual premium costs.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the recent numbers come from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And it is that 1 in 100 children, by the time they reach 8 years of age, will be diagnosed with some form of autism somewhere on the spectrum. And it's even more prevalent in boys. 1 in 58 will be diagnosed with autism. The estimate that we came up with, the $3.60, was in the middle range, and that we don't know for sure. I mean, that's just an estimate, but the actuaries over at Linda Hall's insurance office said that we were in the ballpark with that number. Now, we haven't come up with a new number this year because, you know, the prevalence number has gone up, so it might be higher, but it all depends on how many families are seeking services. And another question that you had asked and you referred to a couple minutes ago was how many might be seeking treatment out of state. And from what they told us over at Providence, very few people seek treatment out of state, and that the vast majority are seeking to get the treatment here closer to home, which is, if we can provide it, was obviously would be better. Mm-hmm. And it's some of the cases that are leaving the state are when children with severe forms of autism that might need a specialist that we might not have available at all here, and there might only be a few in the country. So.
And another, we'll have to, you know, maybe we can ask Linda to come back and, give us further testimony on the cost. And another thing that disturbed me is I went back myself and read the minutes. And this may sound cold-hearted because, we want to address the autism problem and make a treatment available, especially when it's working so well. But we have to look at the cost again because of the... Well, that's what our job as a committee. But he made a statement on the record in the minutes that his cost projections, cost benefit description, was based on a having a workable, adequate is a word, adequate provider system in place. And I just have to ask the question: how far off is that? I mean, he also made a statement, and I think it's been confirmed, that it's not in a place in Alaska, not in place in Alaska. So how far off, and is there, do you think that'll be?
We actually, Mr. Chairman, I got this information from Providence today, and so there, I was actually encouraged about the availability of treatment in Alaska when I read their information. And we also, we were looking back at the questions that were answered or asked by the committee members last year, and so we went out to find some answers. And the, some of the answers were provided by the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. And they told us about the number of autism specialists that are currently being trained, and there's 15 that are in a two-year program right now. And it takes two years, that's a two-year program, but it also takes 1,500 hours of supervised field work. And but once they would complete that, they could be a board certified applied behavior analyst, which is, we actually would need, it's projected we would need about 30 of those in Alaska if we were in a perfect situation. But we do have an additional 6 graduate students that are in the process of working to complete their 1,500 hours. So even though we don't have all the providers that we would, in a perfect world, would like to have at this time, we're actually not as bad off as many of us might have thought we were. And more people will take up this field of study if they feel, if they live in Alaska now and they feel they could stay in Alaska and make a living opening up a business as an autism specialist.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have involves the fact that I know myself, I've had constituents, children who've been dealing with autism in my own family. I have a nephew who had autism, so that I know that it's something that is a growing problem. I'd love to get more clarity about exactly how much it's growing, and if you've got any people testifying to that, I'd really be happy to ask that question. But I also think that this is an issue that is one of those very quiet ones, and it's a condition that if the parents aren't trained, essentially, in really seeing what kinds of behaviors highlight the fact that a child is really facing this, the opportunity, the very kind of very brief opportunity when the child's very young to get in there and actually get treatment, so that in fact they're able to get past the developmental problems, and with the right treatment soon enough, you can get just very, very strong recovery. And that's just having watched it in my own family, it didn't happen. And so the fact that we have this bill before us, that we're talking about this, I think is extremely important, and that it might be a way to sort of make a healthier workforce, and work on that is important. The other thing I'd like to ask about, and a professional might be a good one, the degree to which we can use parents and family members, friends, to help in that recovery is a way to deal with the fact that this is an expensive thing unless you bring people in. And what we found in many of our family-related illnesses, the family can really bring down the costs by being the ones that are trained and helping. And I think in Alaska, we need to be emphasizing that new way of thinking. And it's not that new, but we're not putting in the incentives we need to really build that.
Thank you, Representative Sesta. Now, there was a couple questions there, and what I'd like to do in the next 5 minutes is, you know, so keep track of the questions so you can respond at a later time. I want to get the, any other questions that may be in people's minds on the record so that you'll know what they are, and then we'll go to public testimony. So are there any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Through the chair, are there any private companies that currently cover autism?
Not that I'm aware of in Alaska.
And follow up, to the chair. Do you know why the state currently does not cover autism?
I've heard that there was a meeting with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education with the governor the other day, and he is aware of this legislation. And I personally have not had a meeting with him myself. But, you know, I may go talk to him to see, you know, if he feels it's important for the state to be included on this bill, and then we could put that in the CS. But it's not unusual, from what I understand, having talked to Linda Hall previously, that the state kind of waits and sees, and then if something does get passed on as a mandate for the other companies, then they sign on at a later time. And they would, in this, the effective date of this wouldn't be until January 1st next year if it would were to pass this session. So that would give the state a chance to make their decision to when they wanted, if they wanted to sign on it after the bill passed.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the committee substitute we have, we are talking about medically necessary pharmacy care and psychological care, rehabilitative and therapeutic care required. Often, like on workforce injuries or something, the certification is that the what is performed is medically necessary. But in this case, we're trying to identify anything that would be medically necessary in it. And are there a broad spectrum of services under each one of these categories that would be medically necessary? And so I'm wondering if how we've got this set up, that the requirement is the plan must identify the medically necessary and then all of these different things, that it's the reverse of the normal. And does that mean that for development of that plan, it's going to have to include all of those elements in each one of those categories that might be medically necessary? And does that add to hugely to our expense because it might not be a restrictive one-track line of treatment?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, for example, the way that they do it at Providence is they come up with an exact diagnosis. They spend 20 hours to come up with a diagnosis, so they know where the child falls on the spectrum. And then from there, once they have got that, ascertained, then they can come up with an individual education plan that will help that child make the most improvements over the quickest amount of time. And so they would be the ones that would be making the decisions, since they're the experts in the field. And so the insurance company would be required to pay for what was recommended by the doctors, up to $36,000 a year according to this bill.
Follow up.
And I just like to follow up. I just want to make sure that what your intention is what the wordings are, because the wording is now a statutory requirement that this plan must identify all the medical necessary pharmacy, psychiatric, psychological, rehabilitative, or therapeutic care required. And that might be a much broader list than a plan that's developed that would be sequentially moving in a direction, or a certain plan, because it may, you know, everybody's going to have to cover their rear on this, because any any parent can challenge that, well, you didn't include this that would have been something that's medically necessary, and so I want to make sure that that you check the wording with people in the field that that's not going to be an unintended consequence of the language. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you would, hold your response and just keep the question, because we're going to run out of time. But I want to add to that question. The question I have is that, according to the testimony, only a, there are no biological markers. So can a general practitioner diagnose? The answer is no. So then is there other statutes that include use the definition of medical necessity for psychology, counseling, you know, see what I'm saying? Is that going to be, I think that's unique to the bill, and I want to be thinking about the ramifications of that, and if you would do to respond at a different time, because I think that may be more far-reaching than we, on the surface, it may seem, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would just give you the list of the people over at Providence that they have in their session when they're examining the children. They have an occupational therapist, a speech therapist, a developmental pediatrician, a nurse practitioner, and also social workers are involved so that they can try to find out from the beginning exactly what all types of physical therapy or a behavioral therapy that the child is going to need. So I think that's sort of the standard operating procedure, if you will.
Okay, does anyone else have any questions you want to put on the record for future discussion? Please don't be offended that I'm going to move to public testimony early here, because a lot of people have traveled I think we'll, if it's okay, we'll start with the off-nets, and then we got 30 minutes, and I'll kind of watch the time, but if you would, try to limit your testimony to not over looking at the list here, maybe 3 to 5 minutes, and I think we'll be okay. Chris, are you online? Chris Adler?
I am.
Hello, Chris.
I would defer to Jim Souter. I think he would be a better source for many of your questions.
Okay, thank you. And I think many of us have heard and appreciated your testimony, and we thank you for the brevity and light of the time.
Thanks.
Gwendolyn Lee?
Yes, thank you. I'm here in Anchorage, and I'm sorry I haven't been on since the very beginning, but as the Executive Director for the ARC of Anchorage, I just wanted to weigh in my support for this bill, which is now making it possible for families who have private insurance to access a critical component, which is early intervention. We know that early intervention works across all disabilities, and especially if the diagnosis is some child on the autism spectrum disorder, that early diagnosis, early intervention is critical to ameliorate the long-term care costs of serving autistic individuals. As a provider agency, we see on the other end adults who have never had any kind of treatment, and certainly the children coming through with treatment are in a far better place in terms of quality of life and functioning skill levels. So I applaud this effort, and I think the bill is seems to be well written, because it does have the maximum cap, which I think protects insurance companies a little bit and employers who might worry that a family has a child with autism and their insurance costs are going to go up and consequently the rate, all those kinds of things. But in general, we support this bill.
Thank you, Gwendolyn. Are there any questions for Gwendolyn? Okay, we'll move to in the room. I don't think there's any more online, right? Is there any more online besides?
I'm all by myself here.
Okay, thank you. So in the room, we got a Tanja Updike. Is it Tanja?
Mr. Chair, the council, we wanted to kind of present together.
Okay, what we'll have is the council come up and together.
There's bravery in numbers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we won't bite. We're.
Oh, no.
Why do you think we have so many committees? <Yeah. laughs>
If you would, now, the problem here, the recorder wants to record your statement. So make sure you identify yourself, you know, when you speak. Sometimes it gets into some give and take, you know, and he gets lost and he glares at me and then I got to stop. So if you would, go ahead in whatever order you like, identify yourself and make your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kathleen Fitzgerald, and I am chair of the Developmental Disability Committee for the Governor's Council and chaired the Autism Ad Hoc Committee. And I just wanted to begin by thanking the legislature, both the House and the Senate, for their support of the autism initiatives that we've brought before you over the last several years. We started first by saying we need earlier screening and we need better diagnosis. And we brought that forward to you. We now have an advanced nurse practitioner that's working with Dr. Brennan in the neuro psych developmental clinics are hitting, they're hitting Barrow, Kotzebue, Nome, Bethel, Dillingham, Kodiak, Fairbanks, Juneau, Ketchikan, and of course Anchorage. So we're doing a much, much better job of screening children. We're doing a better job of diagnosing. What I heard you talking about today and what Representative Peterson alluded to is when you're talking about a developmental diagnosis, it's not uncommon at all for any developmental diagnosis to have a multidisciplinary team. So you have the psychologist and the speech-language person and the developmental pediatrician, and because it's looking at the whole child and how it impacts. And so in autism especially, because it's a neurodevelopmental thing that doesn't have a medical marker, those things are even more important. And I think it's interesting to note that because we've gotten so much better at diagnosing our children, that you see more children on a broader spectrum. It used to be that we only saw the very severe children with autism diagnosed with that disability. Now we have a broad spectrum. And so that's why our number is up. And I'm sorry that that Mr. Bowden is not online, because looking at that, actually, when you think about it, the number of children really needing medical treatment are a much smaller portion of that whole autism spectrum, because not all children with autism are going to need applied behavioral analysis. Not all children are going to need all of those really intensive services, but the most intensive children certainly will need the broader array. And that, you know, if you balanced it out, you may have more, but you have less using the full range. So I don't know if that makes any sense to you or not, but that's how it was explained to me, and it sort of made sense, so I don't know. at any rate, thank you for the screening and the diagnostic portions that you put forward. We feel like we're doing a much better job. The council with the Center for Human Development applied for and received one of six federal grants across the country, and it's focusing particularly on identification in rural communities, because we know that in rural communities there's a up to 3-year delay in diagnosing some of those children, 1 to 3 years later than what we pick up in our urban communities. So we have an even stronger focus on trying to identify those children early so we can do those treatments, and helping families, which is the second part of our initiative, the educational and outreach, helping families be able to identify and recognize those signs so that they seek screening and then they're able to receive the appropriate intervention. The third portion of our initiative was, well, okay, now we've diagnosed them, we have information out to parents. So what? What are we going to do? How can we treat them? Because we don't have any practitioners here in our state that are able to apply that. J- Jennifer, I'm proud to say, is ready now to take her, pretty soon, her to be board certified in applied behavioral analysis. And so at that master's and doctoral level, we're beginning to build that through the Center for Human Development. And Dr. Richard Kiefer O'Donnell, we've been able to hook up and are really, through our USED people, able to identify those experts around the country and tie in with our existing system to have a lot more people trained. And we really, really believe within the next 2 years we will have a pretty good option for families. And certainly, I have to tell you, certainly, thank you very much, much better than we had this year or 2 years ago when there was nothing and the only option was, could you afford to go outside or bring those very expensive services locally up as a family? And that brings me to the last portion of our initiative, and that was, so now we've done the screening, the diagnosis, the education, we have the treatment facilities or practitioners here, so how are we going to pay for them? How are we going to really make that service happen? And that is, we believe, one of the first steps is through insurance. I noticed that we have Autism Speaks here that's going to be talking about what other states have been doing. We're not the only state to be bringing this bill forward. It makes sense. In my mind, it's a win-win situation because we have insurance paying, we have families paying. We're working towards perhaps looking at an early intervention waiver. We had begun talking with the division, who were very favorable about moving forward with perhaps applying for that, to be able to do this. And I know I'm taking up a lot of time, but I think it's really critical to see that we've spent a lot of time, energy, and thought in really developing a thorough system so that families no longer are isolated up here without the ability to have appropriate service. I have a daughter, 27, who's nonverbal, in diapers. And had this been available, I believe that her situation would be much different. So this is an important bill. Huh. Millie, did you have?
No. Okay. Now let me talk. Okay. Hello, my name is Tanya Updike. I am a new member to the Governor's Council on Special Education and Disability, but my most important role is mother. I have three beautiful children. Not biased at all. but my middle child experiences autism. When my son was, I'd say, 14 months old, we were very concerned. He was very different than his older brother, and we wanted to be good parents and not base everything on our first child, of course. But he didn't seem to be acting like his older brother. He didn't talk. He had very little interest in moving. He would not go to anyone else other than myself. I stayed at home pretty much the entire time his first year. He wouldn't go to his father. He did not like leaving the house. He did not like new people. I did not put him down. It wasn't that he would cry. Most babies cry. It was that he was terrified. He would not stop crying. When we went to Hawaii on vacation, my oldest son was running down the beach and, look, mommy, there's a plane, there's water, there's, and my middle son, my second child, he actually had his head buried in the sand because it was too overwhelming for him. It was horrible. On the whole plane ride home, my husband and I looked at each other and we went, we do not know what's going on. This is not normal. We were very fortunate. We went to our infant learning program. We have an amazing infant learning program in our area. And we couldn't actually go to the infant learning program because, like I said, my son would not leave the house. We were fortunate. They came to our house. They brought therapists with them. And they spent an hour with us. And I stayed on the stairway with my son screaming while they were in the living room talking to my husband, and we were trying to answer questions over my son screaming. It took a year for us to get my son into the therapy clinic so he could receive services. That was a year of me dragging him, kicking and screaming. So he was not receiving the actual therapy services for that year, but we were working on getting him to the clinic to receive those services. He is now 7 years old. He is a beautiful little boy who now can speak. However, he does what a lot of autistics do. He dialogues. He's memorized every Disney movie ever. And he would sit there and dialogue a Disney movie to you, but he would not know how to tell you that his stomach hurt. He would not know how to ask where the bathroom is. Those things just are completely lost to him. I truly believe that without the early intervention, he would not be speaking. He did not speak until he was 5. He did not become potty trained until he was 6. He is in a special education classroom, but it's a constant battle. And I am one person, and I'm very lucky. I have my family around me. I have amazing people who help mentor me. But I'm a fortunate parent. I caught it early. I received services early. And we have insurance, but it's constantly being thrown back at me, denied. They say autism is something you will grow out of. You do not. As Representative Cisna made a good point of, it's something that without treatment, it does not get better. I'm not saying that my son will one day wake up and not have autism. He will always have autism. But I'm hopeful that someday he will actually be an active member in our community. I was born and raised in Soldotna. I want to keep my kids here. And I love the idea of my son to be able to get treatments like our member here would be able to provide, because that's one thing that he has not had. I believe that this bill would help so many families just to be able to stay in the state, which I think is very important, to not have to leave the state for different therapies and treatments, and to be able to give our children the necessary tools to be able to be in the community, be able to have jobs. That's my dream for my son, and I know many other families have that that wish. So sorry, that's just my story. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you.
In talking about cost savings.
Identify yourself.
I'm sorry, this is Kathy Fitzgerald again. In talking about cost savings, I think we answered a lot of questions, and we talked about special education, and we've brought before you in the past lots of information about early intervention and why it's important. I would like to make a recommendation or suggestion on the language in this bill, just in thinking about some of the how it's written on perhaps on line 28 under applicability, that you would add after the word issued for delivery, delivered, comma, administered, comma, or.
Which page?
On page 3. Sorry, line 28.
Line what?
I wanted it to say, I wanted to add the word administered after the issued for delivery, comma, delivered, comma, administered, comma, or, and then the continuation of the sentence. And that would cover insurance companies who were operating out of, you know, states in the lower 48 who were doing business here. That would ensure that they would also be responsible for those coverages in our state.
Did you catch that? You got that?
Did people have to ask
if you? If you would, get it specifically to the Matt after the, so we can consider it. Okay. It was a question. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you. And just for clarification, I think your amendment was made to the original bill. We have the committee substitute before us.
Thank you.
If you would look at a copy of that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm Millie Ryan. I'm the executive director of the council, and I helped put together some information to answer some of the questions that the committee had. I think there were 7 of them, and so if you had any questions about any of those things, I can see what I can do to answer them to the best of my ability.
Yep, Millie, thank you. I'd like to ask you a question. I want to explain a little bit. Really the question before this committee is not whether or not to advocate to push for treatment. Early treatment and early intervention. The question is whether or not it's the best way to do it. If using the numbers that we've been supplied, if there's 48,000 potential that were mandating four, which is 20, you know, a portion of the total number of children in the state, and we use the prevalence of one per 100, we're talking 480 children. Okay, if we spend $2,000 a person on those children, that's a nearly $1 million. So my the another alternative might be a whole lot better, to come up with some kind of a government program, you know, where we're actually providing the autism care, rather than, because we don't know. See, the problem is that in my mind, the problem is that we're going back and we're mandating a cost on the insurance premiums that we can't really figure out how much we're paying. You know, is it more than that $1 million? And you know, if we spend $1 million to set up a therapy center, it seems to me like it would be there for everybody in the state, rather than just 23% of them. And it may not be. And then one other. Well, I'll let you respond to that first.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think part of the reason that we're looking at the private insurance coverage is that you're really sharing the cost. You know, insurance companies are there to cover health costs. One of the kinds of health care cost is making sure that people with autism have the kinds of health care services that they need. So it's really that the insurance company would pay their share. Families might pay additional. The state certainly, I think, has a responsibility to provide services. But it's basically we want something that's not going to hit either any one of those sort of three thing, either families or insurance companies or the state having to bear the majority of the costs. I don't know if you want to add anything there. I don't know if that makes sense.
It's just a response to that. Insurance companies sell a commodity, so they collect premiums, and they make, I think Mr. Bowden said they make roughly 15% is the number they used in the cost-benefit ratio. You know, all I'm saying is, if you take that 15% and forget it, it's just a pure cost. It seems like straight dollars might be better than going out. Because one of the problems we have in Alaska is that we have trouble getting insurance companies to come up here and provide policies. And if we don't know what the straw is that'll break the camel's back. But Alaska is very unique because of its remoteness. And if we add just the wrong number of mandates, then we lose another person, possible source of insurance for our people. You know, it can have ramifications that are very hard to measure. Did you want to respond to that, Millie?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think Mr. Bowder's, when he did his actuarials, and what he did, it was very much similar to what other states have come up with. It generally is no more than $3.60 a month per member. So it's not an outrageous amount of money that's being asked. And of course, you know, if you have every different group that comes on and wants $3.60 here, it does add up. I will grant you that. But I think in terms of the dollar amount there, that is fairly reasonable to provide the coverage that's needed.
Yeah, okay. And any other questions? Representative Wilson?
Through the chair, is it Tanya? Is that right?
Yes.
I didn't quite understand whether the insurance, it's probably me, whether the insurance that you had did pay for most of your care, or how much
it
out of pocket?
It does not. And actually, my husband has a very good job. He works for Chevron on the platform, but they do not pay for it. The state actually pays for part of what my son gets. He gets TEFRA, which is a form of Medicaid, and it's based on a child's income, which obviously he makes no income, so he's able to get it through that. But the therapies that he receives is very minimal. We actually do a lot of therapies at home. But most families, you know, don't always know about TEFRA, aren't able to go through the process of it if they don't have a good care provider that's helping them through the process. A lot of families do it themselves, so they mortgage their house. We're a very fortunate family in that we're able to get some of his therapies paid through for the state. But no, insurance does not cover his therapy. They say that it's a delay or it's something he will grow out of, so he doesn't need services for it.
Follow-up, sir?
Follow-up.
To the chair. So currently you haven't been out of pocket for any cost at this,
yes,
at this point?
Yes, we have. We've been out of pocket for some of it. I'd say our own pocket, not the insurance pocket. We kind of match what the state does to make sure that my son is able to get therapies in our home as well as in a therapy setting. Therapy setting the state does pay for, but in the home we pay for.
Can you give me kind of an idea? I'm just trying to get a kind of cost idea. I'm not trying to go into your...
A cost idea. That I don't
know. I mean, just approximately how much you put out per year.
Jennifer, do you know how much?
I'm Jennifer Card, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the state of Alaska, but I'm also a parent of a child with autism. And I I moved up here 6 years ago, and my son was 5 and a half, and it was such turmoil trying to get him services. A bad thing with the school district, and I end up started thinking about getting my own certification so I know how to take care of my child. So I have a master's degree in social work, and I went and started getting my certification in applied behavioral analysis, and so I'm about a test away from being done. So I'm pretty excited about that. But the point of it is that I had to go and get this certification so I knew what to do with my son. And I do know that board certified behavioral analysts, they charge about $100 to $125 an hour, and you need the support staff to be able to support a home program, which TEFRA Medicaid doesn't really cover right now. That you can get a DD waiver if you're lucky to get off the list, and then have someone come in your home if you can find a care provider. If you can go through all those steps, I have yet to have a care provider come in my home since I've been here. And so you would have to pay those support staff.
I think it's $15 an hour.
It would be about $15 an hour
for support
staff, 30 hours a week. Mm-hmm. 30 hours a week. And a lot of people are paying for that out of pocket. And if you don't have that extra money, where do you go? I'm in the public health service. Happen to be here in the state of Alaska. TRICARE does cover the BCBA portion of it, but they don't pay for the help. So I'm kind of like, well, what do I do? You know, unless you pay out of pocket.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Remember now, we're getting down, and we have two more testifiers in the room, so please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The questions I have are the ones that I had mentioned. I'm really concerned about the outcome cost, and I hear what you're saying. At the very same time, we're going through this huge procedure right now, and it's as a result of not having in-state services for our children. And we found, and the State Department of Health and Social Services had the costs of having to do out-of-state care, figured it out that we couldn't afford to send our kids out of state. And I'm asking, and haven't gotten clarification, we have about 100 kids out of state, and if any of those are autistic, and what level we're at that, because are we paying a huge amount for not having care done in this state? And we're finding out on the mental health that it's extraordinarily expensive. So what's happening on this?
It's Millie Ryan again, Representative Sisna through the chair. Oh, I got that right. the last statistics I saw on Bring the Kids Home, there's about 118 kids who are still out of state, and those are the kids with the most severe issues. Of those, a certain percentage had developmental disabilities, and then another, I would say, okay, so it's about 50 kids that either had a developmental disability or autism. And probably the kids with autism or Asperger's were maybe half again of that. So somewhere around 25 kids or so, some of whom might be eligible for a waiver under the mental retardation developmental disability waiver that the Division of Senior and Disability Services offers, or they were waiting for services to see if they were eligible. So I would say that somewhere around of the 25, probably half of those were with very severe autism. And they are, as I said, did not necessarily get any early intervention. They're folks that just need a lot of assistance. We'd really like to figure out how we can best serve them here in Alaska. And that's one of the things that the Bring the Kids Home group is going to be doing, is looking at how do we really serve folks who have the most severe disabilities. I think it's going to take perhaps a different sort of provider than we currently have in the state that has some very specialized expertise, because they don't really fit in terms of kids who have emotional disturbances. They present very differently. Similarly, kids with FASD, they present differently, and you need to approach their treatment differently. So I think that's something we're going to have to spend some time out really figuring out, how do we best support them here in Alaska.
Mr. Chair, follow-up if I may.
Follow-up.
Thank you very much. And then the other part of that, you either get services where there are services, they're out of state, and so you either get families broken up, or you drive families away. And then that drives away resources oftentimes that this state really has trouble with keeping our resources in our state. We have a lot of turnover. There is a cost with that. I'd eventually like to see all of this stuff worked out financially so that we really see where we're going. But the second part of this is we don't give service. And the cost of having a child not get services and the outcome of that and the cost to society, I'd like to know if anything's been done on that one.
Okay. Yeah.
Just a Gantt study? Yeah. Mm-hmm. How'd you have it? Okay. I have mine. Okay. There's a study that was done by Michael Gantz. He's Millie Ryan again, a Harvard economist. And he basically said, based on looking at a number of different studies and running the numbers, that it costs about $3.2 million per capita to not provide services at the time when it's most needed, which is as soon as the child is diagnosed.
Okay. If you have any other questions, please contact them individually. We have two more left. One's all the way from South Carolina in the room, and then now Jim Bowder just called in, and we've got 2 to 3 minutes left is all we have, but with the indulgence of the committee, I really want to hear these folks. So,
and I feel like I can answer many of the questions that you brought up, so please hit me with them if you want to. My name is Lori Unum. I'm the parent of an 8-year-old son with autism. I'm also an attorney. I'm formerly with the United States Department of Justice. I'm also formerly a law professor at George Washington University Law School. But I gave up my legal career to advocate full-time on behalf of kids with autism when I saw the inequity in the insurance arena, particularly. Now I'm senior policy advisor and counsel for Autism Speaks, which is the nation's largest nonprofit research and advocacy organization for autism. And I thank you for allowing me to come here to your state to show my support for HB 187. Autism is a medical condition brought on through no fault of the family. It's diagnosed by a medical doctor. Treatment is prescribed by a medical doctor. The term autism is actually used imprecisely, even within the autism community. Some people use it interchangeably with autism spectrum disorder, and others use it to mean one of the autism spectrum disorders. The diagnostic manual actually has an umbrella category called pervasive developmental disorders, and there are 5 distinct diagnoses within it. The 3 in purple on the slide there are the autism spectrum disorders, and the 3 are autistic disorder, which some people call just autism, and that's the more severe one. Autistic disorder accounts for only about 1/3 of all autism spectrum disorders. There's also the category called Asperger's syndrome. That's your more high-functioning people, kind of like Rain Man, if you remember that movie. Sometimes they have splinter skills. They're usually highly vocal with great vocabularies. That is less than 1/6 of all autism spectrum disorders. And then there's kind of a catch-all category, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, or PDD-NOS. That is a much milder form. These are kids who don't meet the qualifications for any of the other diagnoses, and that accounts for about 1/2 of all autism spectrum disorder. Now, although there's no known cure for autism, it can be treated so that the symptoms are not disabling. As you've heard, a nonverbal child can be taught to communicate. A non-social child can be taught to interact. I'm told by a neurologist friend that this therapy, applied behavior analysis, actually changes the wiring in the brain such that it can be detected on a brain scan. So there is a physiological change that results from applied behavior analysis therapy. The most commonly prescribed treatment protocol is this ABA therapy. This is a therapy that's been used for many decades to treat children with autism, and yet the insurance industry continues to deny coverage for it, often on the basis that it is experimental. I've got copies of policies from Blue Cross Blue Shield, from Cigna, showing that they have some coverage for autism, but they explicitly exclude applied behavior analysis therapy. So the one thing that your doctor is prescribing to you and telling you you need to get this very intensively if there's any hope for your child is excluded explicitly in the policy by the insurers. This position of the insurers is simply no longer supported by the science. ABA therapy is not experimental. The National Research Council has said so. The Surgeon General has said so. The American Academy of Pediatrics has said so. There was a federal district court decision just earlier this month in Oregon that explicitly addressed this argument and ruled ABA therapy is not experimental or investigational in nature. Now, studies show that if ABA is administered intensively and by properly trained therapists, approximately half of the kids will overcome their disabling condition to the extent that they can go to first grade indistinguishable from their peers. The seminal study actually found 47% of the kids who got the therapy went to a mainstream first grade indistinguishable from their peers. It's an amazing statistic, isn't it? The other half also make significant gains. Maybe they can't be mainstreamed without support, but they make significant, clinically significant gains. As I mentioned, though, ABA therapy must be administered intensively, and thus it's quite expensive. Now, my own son's autism is very severe. He has autistic disorder, which is the most severe of the three that I mentioned, and he is on the severe end of that, unfortunately. His therapy has cost us out of pocket $75,000 per year, out of pocket. We have been audited on our taxes three times because of that kind of extraordinary medical expense. Now, most kids don't require anything close to that much. Like I said, he is one of the most severe, but some do. My husband and I are blessed with good jobs and good educations, and we've been able to make sacrifices to afford the therapy for our son. We sold our house, we moved to a less expensive house so that we could use the difference to pay for his therapy. Not that the difference added up to that much, but we made many sacrifices. But, you know, how many Alaska families do you know that could make that kind of sacrifice and come up with that kind of money, or even half that much? Most can't, of course, and those kids are simply going untreated. I think it is sad that in the United States of America, we know of a treatment that undoubtedly works, and yet if you're not fortunate enough to be born into a wealthy family, you can't get it. And it's not only sad, it's unfair, because these are families who are doing the right thing. They're paying their insurance premiums. That they're doing what we want families to do. They have procured insurance for their family to insure against exactly this kind of unforeseen and unprovoked medical disaster, and they deserve coverage. The witnesses before me mentioned the 2006 study from Harvard that projected a lifetime cost of caring for a person with autism who does not get this treatment of $3.2 million over their lifetime. Now, that study includes both direct and indirect costs, such as lost productivity. So I also like to refer to a Pennsylvania study that was done in 1998 that just looked at the direct cost, and it was over $1 million per person that the state incurs for each child who is not treated with autism. Now, you can do the math as well as I can. If you've got about 1 in 100 kids in Alaska being diagnosed with autism these days, and only the wealthy few are getting this treatment, you take each remaining child and multiply that by over $1 million. And that's how much Alaska taxpayers are going to have to shell out for these kids over their lifetimes. And if you think, you know, I think Representative Cisna had asked about the increase in prevalence. Here's a chart that shows 25 years ago, the prevalence rate was 1 in 2,500. 15 years ago, the prevalence rate was 1 in 500. And just recently, the CDC came out with that 1 in 110 figure. So you can't really say to yourselves, well, we'll just handle these kids or these individuals in our state budget the way we've always handled them, because they haven't always been around. The prevalence rate is so much greater now. There is an autism tsunami that is going to hit the state of Alaska. They're going to cost an extraordinary amount of money in special education, in adult supports, in institutionalization, sadly, if the kids don't get the services they need. Now, faced with this reality, other states, 15 to be specific, have enacted insurance reform in the last couple of years. Well, actually, 14 have passed it in the last few years. South Carolina, where I'm from, in 2007, Texas, then in 2008, Arizona, Florida, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and last year, Montana, New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, Connecticut, Wisconsin, and New Jersey. You see over on the left-hand side, I've got Indiana and Minnesota. Indiana actually passed a similar mandate in 2001 with no dollar caps in it, Representative Seaton, and no age cap for treatment. And Minnesota, I've got a little asterisk beside, did not do this by statute. The Attorney General of Minnesota sued their major insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, for failure to cover kids with autism, and that litigation was settled such that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, since 2001, has covered kids with autism, or individuals with autism, I should say, throughout the lifetime, including ABA therapy with no dollar cap. Now, one of the reasons that I'm here today, obviously, you can tell I'm not from around these parts. I originally wrote the legislation in South Carolina back in 2005 that kind of started this whole movement over the last couple of years, and I have seen it successfully implemented. Children who have never before been able to get treatment are making remarkable progress. Providers have joined adequate networks and have negotiated satisfactory reimbursement rates. And by the way, we didn't have that many certified behavior analysts either at the time we passed the legislation, and our number has almost doubled in 2 years. I'm not sure if that's people moving into the state. I think more likely you've got some people who were not certified, but were kind of on their way to getting certified, and once a funding stream came into place, they went out and got that certification. They took the test, or they took the coursework, or whatever else it was they needed to get their certification. And also, I can say that despite the doomsday predictions we heard from the insurance industry when we were trying to get this passed in South Carolina, the premium increase has been minuscule. No insurers have fled the state. None of our businesses have thrown in the towel. You know, when I was trying to get it passed in 2006 and 2007, I called the Indiana Department of Insurance to say, what has the impact on premiums been? And they actually had not collected the data in any meaningful way, or they had not assimilated it, I should say. They collected it, and they just said to me, the impact on premiums has been, quote, unmeasurable. That's how small it was. Now, I also should mention that this map shows what other states are currently working on this legislation right now. A similar bill is pending in 19 states right now. I actually testified in Iowa yesterday on this bill, and it's in development also in a number of other states. So it definitely is, you're not alone in pursuing this insurance for kids with autism. The health insurance industry's own association, the Council for Affordable Health Insurance, puts together a report every year called Health Insurance Mandates in the States. And it goes through every single mandate that exists in any state, and it says what the estimated impact on premiums has been from those mandates. So like alcoholism, for instance, those mandates cost between 1 and 3%. Prescription mandates, 5 to 10%. Their own association says that autism mandates cost less than 1%. And we, Autism Speaks, has contracted for a number of different states. We have contracted with an independent actuarial firm called Oliver Wyman to produce actuarial studies on bills that are pending. We would be happy to contract with Oliver Wyman for an independent study on HB 187 if that's something that you'd be interested in. I also know Jim Bowder, who I don't know if he's still on the phone or not. He's a very good friend of mine. But if you're interested in having this independent study, we'd be happy to provide to get one done on your bill. And just so you know, in every state where this actuarial study has been produced, the impact was less than 1%, and it's held true in every state. I'm trying to rush through, so I guess just a couple of quick things. One, in Minnesota, where, again, the coverage has been in place since 2001, the per member per month premium increase is 83 cents per month. That is significantly less than 1%. And just so you know, the average cost per patient for ABA therapy, $30,000. And remember, Minnesota has no dollar cap. There is no $36,000 cap or no $50,000 cap. Minnesota is unlimited, but the average per patient cost for ABA is $30,000. One other point I'll make, and then I'll wrap up. In South Carolina, we did include our state employee health plan within the mandate, and data came out earlier this week as to exactly how much it had cost. The mandate was applicable to our state health plan as of January 1 of last year, so we've got one full year of claims cost. Our population is 4.5 million, and we have 350,000 members in our state health plan, so obviously we're considerably larger. And our budget office, our state fiscal analyst, had predicted that the impact would be between 9 million and 18.9 million per year. The actual cost for all of 2009, as just released earlier this week, was $856,371. And if you divide that over the number of members, it increased premiums by 20 cents per month per member. It's pretty minuscule to think that kids with autism could get the treatment they need by asking each person to cough up an extra 20 cents. I guess I'm going to, I've got many more things I could say, but I guess I'll stop to be respectful of your time. But if you have questions, particularly any of the questions that you posed that weren't answered, I'd be happy to respond.
Yeah, thank you so much. And if you have a card, you know, you could get to all of us, and then, we, you know, as we reflect on these things, we'll probably have, no doubt, as follow-up
I'd be glad
questions.
To. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can we get a copy of this of the slide?
Oh, thank you. I was going to ask.
The slideshow, absolutely. I didn't even finish everything, but I will send it to you so you can get it.
And then, Jim, are you online?
Yes, I am.
If we have your testimony, of course, on record, easily available online, and if anyone wants to see those in the minutes, you know, and don't know how to find it, please contact my office. So the reason I mention that is I would appreciate it very much if you would limit your comments to not include repetition. we're over time here. We had a power outage earlier, put us on a glitch, and we actually had a time pretty good, except you know, the generator didn't agree. So go ahead with your testimony, Jim.
I did prepare a benefit cost analysis report. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for the opportunity for me to share my findings. My name is Jim Bowder. I'm the chief operating officer of a private school and partial hospitalization program that serves children severely impacted by autism in Pennsylvania. At around the same time, Lori, the speaker that you just heard, was working on her on legislation down in South Carolina. I was working with Pennsylvania's Speaker of the House to draft autism insurance coverage legislation that would ultimately become law a couple of years ago, and we're now nearing our first the end of our first year of implementation. While the Pennsylvania legislation was being considered, I completed a cost analysis and submitted it to a group called the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council, which was an organization established to provide an independent review of mandate proposals to determine various things, including the social needs, the social impact of the coverage, and the cost and benefit to Pennsylvanians. During that time, I developed a cost model that is consistent with the standards of the American Academy of Actuaries, and it enabled the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council to confirm that the cost of Pennsylvania's proposed mandate, which in many ways is similar to the proposed House Bill 187, and they determined, as Lori had alluded to, that the cost of extending private insurance coverage to children with autism was in fact less than 1%. I did a similar study. I believe you should have a copy of it, so I won't go through it line by line. The good part version is that applying the methodology that I've applied in Pennsylvania, I testified numerous times in Louisiana, West Virginia, Michigan, and Alaska last session, I found that, same as in other states, Alaska can expect no greater impact on premiums than under 1%. Now, Lori also mentioned that the lack of insurance coverage results in a scarcity of providers. And once you have that funding stream available, providers will enter your marketplace. But for the first several years after enactment, you're going to experience a gradual increase in cost attributable to the mandate. You won't see that just slightly under 1% impact all in the first year. It'll more than likely be spread across a good number of years, anywhere from 4, 5, or 6 years. So the notion that this will have such a dramatic impact on premiums that it will cause people to drop their insurance, employers to drop their insurance coverage, or cause insurance companies to leave the state, simply isn't borne out by the evidence. While my cost analysis was one of the first to examine the explicit cost impact of autism insurance mandates on premiums, over the years that followed the Pennsylvania's mandate going into going through the legislature and becoming law, groups such as Oliver Wyman that Lori mentioned, Mercer, Aon, actuarial firms you probably recognize, have all confirmed that have all reached findings that were consistent with mine, that in fact you are not going to see a significant impact in premiums. After you have an adequate network of providers in Alaska, my estimate is that ratepayers will experience an average dollar impact of about $3.60 per month. And they wouldn't realize that full $3.60 per month impact until, of course, there were enough providers to meet the demand in Alaska. Just one other short thing. There was a Lori mentioned some benefit cost studies. My research was to demonstrate what the cost would be. Insurance mandates are oftentimes regarded in two ways. One is a cost driver, and the other is an investment. As a cost driver, this mandate is not a significant driver of cost. As an investment, I would refer you to written testimony that was submitted by a colleague of mine from Texas, John Hockenius. John found in his study, looking at the actuarial work that I prepared for your committee, that the lifetime savings per child by extending these services to children in Alaska will be approximately $667 million over the lifespan of children with autism in Alaska. So in terms of investment, there's a significant return. A low investment upfront, a significant return of investment on investment over time in the form of avoided services. These children will get jobs. They'll become taxpayers. You will avoid significant human service costs in the future. So this is an important piece of legislation, one that I don't want to just reduce this to the economic benefit to Alaskans. This certainly will bring tremendous human benefit, as you've heard from other speakers who have gone before me. But I don't believe the legislature has anything to fear of this mandate creating significant costs and putting an undue burden on your businesses or making it difficult for insurance companies to operate in your state. And now, if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I see none. I really thank you for calling in, Mr. Browder, and thank you for your good information. And we have the contact information, so there may be some questions forthcoming. Is that acceptable?
That sure is.
Okay, great. Thank you again for calling in to testify. And Representative Seat.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to pose one other question so that we get it on the record so it can be handled next time. On page one of the committee substitute, on line 11, well, actually nine, starting on line 9, it says coverage for the cost of the treatment required by this section must cover the treatment of the disorders prescribed by a licensed physician or psychologist and provided by an autism service provider as identified in the treatment plan. And I am wanting the sponsor to look at that and see if we are therefore excluding care that's normally provided under like a waiver or those things, that then we're requiring that the only persons that can provide any of the care underneath this plan has to be either the doctoral master, baccalaureate degree with the behavioral sciences. These categories that we have, the way I read it, are the only people that can provide any of the services under the treatment plan. And I don't think that that's what is meant by the by there, but I wanted to bring it up so it could be addressed.
Okay. And I assume the sponsor got the question? I see nodding heads, and I think we're okay. So with that, we'll adjourn at 5:22, and I thank you for your patience today with the generator.